What do you do on Sundays?
We talk about Cate Blanchett, the acting, the costumes, the awards, but mostly the Blanchett of it all.
Oh, I'm not acting.
You think this is a love affair?
I saw you, Erica, meeting in the middle.
This is Sundays with Cate, and I'm your host, Murtada El-Fadl.
Welcome to Sundays with Cate, the podcast series about the films of Cate Blanchett. Thank you for your patience while we regrouped after our first season of 13 episodes. We're back. This is your host, Murtada El-Fadl. And with me today on the first episode of the three episodes about Blue Jasmine is writer and critic Matthew Eng. Hi, Matthew.
Hi, Murtada.
How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Great. I'm so excited to have you on the pod to talk about Blue Jasmine.
Yes, there's a lot to say, I'm sure, about this performance and also the film.
Yeah. And this, what we want to talk about a little bit today is that when you look at the career of Cate Blanchett, there is, without a doubt, two movies that people agree are her top. Mm-hmm. Which is Blue Jasmine and Carol, and surprisingly, she did them right after each other in 2013 and 2015. And, you know, sometimes, some days, I'm like, Blue Jasmine is her best performance. Some days, I'm like, Carol is her best performance.
Okay.
I've just seen Blue Jasmine. I think it's her best performance, so this is the day for that. But we also wanted to talk in this movie because, unlike Carol, which has other elements that you can love. You can love other performances. You can love the cinematography, the writing, the direction. I think when you watch Blue Jasmine, it's about Cate's performance. Mm-hmm. And so for this episode, we're going to talk about the theory of, like, can actors be auteurs? And this is a perfect movie for that. Mm-hmm. Do you agree?
I definitely agree, because I really don't refer to Blue Jasmine as Woody Allen's anymore. I just sort of refer to it as Cate Blanchett's. Yeah, and that just feels accurate to me.
It does feel accurate to me, too. So, what is Blue Jasmine about? Blue Jasmine came out in July 2013. Mm-hmm. It was about a New York, from IMDb, a New York socialite, deeply troubled and in denial, arrived in San Francisco to impose upon her sister. She looks like $1 million, but isn't bringing money, peace, or love. Okay, IMDb.
very judgmental. Okay. Yeah. Blue Jasmine for fucking film.
Yeah, they are. So Blue Jasmine, always people talk about it as sort of a riff on A Streetcar Named Desire. Mm-hmm. So Jasmine, like Blanche DuBois, comes to visit her sister. There is a man in her past and men in her past, but mm-hmm. there is also men in her present who are making this visit terrible for her and for her sister.
Yeah, so it's, yeah, I think of it as like A Streetcar Named Desire as filtered through the Bernie Madoff scandal, right? So there's the Bernie Madoff scandal, obviously involved this guy who had done this Ponzi scheme where he cheated so many people out of millions of dollars, and then, you know, was caught and suffered the consequences for it, yeah. And then died. But so it's interesting to think of, yeah, like what these two, what like this sort of tabloid friendly story mm-hmm. would look like if it was reinterpreted in the terms of, you know, one of the most classic plays of the American theater.
Yep.
And then put on film, obviously, starring one of our greatest actresses.
Yeah. And I think that's where the screenplay pops, like that sort of bringing, mm-hmm. it's obviously a retreat, despite Alan never admitting to that. It's so obviously a retreat of Streetcar, but it also brings to your point that at the time that scandal was like in the news. This movie was released a couple of years after that.
Yeah.
And everybody who sees it also saw the allusions to Bernie Madoff and to Ruth Madoff.
I have a theory that like Woody has written all of his screenplays in the 70s and 80s and is just, that's, he just has been churning them out. Like he just like went on a writing spree for 2 decades because some of these screenplays are just so incredibly dated.
Yes.
And like they feel like they could only belong to a previous time where maybe these characterizations or maybe these scenarios would have been accepted. But I would say Blue Jasmine is like one of his more recent films that feels almost of its moment in a way. Mm-hmm. You know, it's touching on, obviously, this really notorious news story, but it's, I think it belongs to its time in a way that you can't say for maybe any number of the films yeah. he's made around that movie. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, if you compare it to Wonder Wheel, Blue Jasmine feels very modern.
Right.
Which is the movie that he did a couple of years after Blue Jasmine. But Kate appears immediately. So unlike The Aviator, where we had to wait almost half an hour for her to appear, or other movies where she's very briefly in them, Blue Jasmine is all about Kate Blanchett. So if you're yes. a Kate Blanchett fan, this is the movie. You've probably already watched it 7 times. But mm-hmm. if you haven't, this is the movie to watch. She immediately appears right after the credits, jabbering away on a plane to a stranger, telling her all about lovemaking and her life with her husband and why she left college, and all kinds of stories that you feel are real but also are lies. And sort of that scene immediately establishes the character. This is somebody who talks a lot. This is somebody who's very self-centered, who's narcissistic. Mm-hmm. And it also establishes that this is a performance that you're not mm-hmm. going to be able to take your eyes off.
Yes. And it's interesting because it feels almost, I would say, since the Elizabeth movies, like her biggest showcase, mm-hmm. right? So she's right there from the get-go. And there's really nary a scene throughout the movie that doesn't spotlight her, except for, you know, some extraneous Sally Hawkins, Bobby Cannavale mm-hmm. stuff. But yeah, so it feels like you're primed right from the get-go for like full throttle Blanchett, which yeah. is exciting to see. Even though it feels sometimes like the film or the screenplay aren't entirely ready for just like the heightened intensity that she's bringing to this yeah. part in every interaction.
Yeah. I mean, Kate is always somebody who's dominant on yes. screen. And yes. this is definitely the most dominant, even though the other actors are no slouches. Like Sally Hawkins plays her sister. Bobby Cannavale plays Sally Hawkins' boyfriend. Mm-hmm. So he's the Stanley in this scenario. Right. There is Andrew Dice Clay, who is Sally's ex-husband. Alec Baldwin is Kate's ex-husband. Mm-hmm. And
Peter Sarsgaard is sort of like the Mitch, I guess, of if we're looking at it in the streetcar cosmology.
Exactly.
Like, you know, the new suitor. Who she's, you know, pulling the wool over.
Yeah, who might offer her salvation.
Right, but then doesn't.
Just like Mitch.
Just like Mitch.
I could not believe, when I first saw this movie, you know, I was there opening night at the Angelica.
Were you?
Yes, that okay. Friday when it opened, I was there at the Angelica, the longest lines I've ever seen. It's just like from the very beginning, like we just like, she hold the screens. And I remember like there's 3 minutes in after she lands and she goes, there's mm-hmm. a cab driver who takes her to Sally's apartment and Sally's not there. And there is, and he's like crowding her. And mm-hmm. Kate yeah. is trembling and just so overwhelmed. Jasmine is overwhelmed by the fact that she's there, but Sally's not there. What is happening? And she looks at the cab driver and she's like, can I have some privacy, while her whole body is shaking. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, wow, I'm going to yeah. love this. This is a great performance. This is a big performance. This is something, it's a whole body performance. It's a big performance. Like, she's not going to let go. This is not going to be some subtle work.
Yeah. And I think what's interesting about that moment in particular, and my last viewing a couple days ago, it definitely stuck out to me, where I feel like most of Woody's writing is really noted for its economy. Mm-hmm. So it's, you know, I mean, they're not necessarily like the longest scenes. I mean, although he has written some very extended dialogue sequence scenes. But, yeah, this one, it's just like, it goes on much longer than you expect, and the camera's just sort of holding to her. And really what's happening is not major by any means. It's not driving the story forward, but we're just sort of, he's just like immersing us in this behavioral study of a woman clearly at her mm-hmm. wit's end, but, you know, in the most, one of the most mundane circumstances, like she can't find, like she needs to get into an apartment mm-hmm. and she can't do that. And so, yeah, it's, and in that, even in that, earliest scene, I get the sense that Blanchett's performance is sort of even just like dictating Woody's own interest and in what he's going to capture in this film. Mm-hmm. Like, it's not going to just be, you know, snappy dialogue scenes between lovers or siblings or stuff like that. It's going to be, you know, almost like an extended look at this
one person, yeah, one character.
Yeah. So she almost, in a way, transforms it into a character portrait.
Mm-hmm. With the force of the performance.
Yes, 100%. And it's so, I mean, the theatricality of it, I think, just stands out mm-hmm. immediately. Where you understand, even, you know, as she's on that plane, just jabbering away, that watching a performer working in a very deliberately theatrical mm-hmm. register. So, you know, realism isn't the point of this performance. It's foregrounding a type of artifice that's going to be interesting to witness, especially in relation to these other performers who aren't necessarily, who are playing it kind of straight in a way.
Yeah, who are not doing that same thing. So she's always going to stand out. And I love that you said that because this was the first big movie that Kate did after taking 6 years off mm-hmm. to run the Sydney Theatre Company and do a lot of stage work.
Yeah.
And when she won the Oscar, she talked about how this performance is a synthesis of her work on stage and on film.
Yes, you can absolutely see that because it's important to note that she had played Blanche Dubois in a production directed by Liv Ullmann. Mm-hmm. I think maybe, I don't know what year it was exactly.
I think it was definitely a few 2012, years before. Before that, maybe 2008, 9, something like that.
Yeah. So it's interesting to look at it, obviously, over the course of her career and how, like, you know, her extended time with the Sydney Theatre Company, but also her experience playing, you know, the character who is most directly responsible for Jasmine, how that's going to feed into this performance, but, you know, on a filmic level so that the outsizedness of it is sort of, it needs to be reined in just like a little bit, even though she's not really reining it in.
She's not, but it's a very controlled performance. Like, everything is controlled. And I think some of people who have a problem with this performance think of it as maybe too controlled because it's very calculated. Like, she's always calculating the amount of pills or mm-hmm. booze that's in the system of Jasmine in every performance, calculating that with external aids like sweat, like the way way her hair is falling. God, yeah. Like, everything is, yes, you look at her and you know, okay, Jasmine is drunk or Jasmine is high on Xanax mm-hmm. or Jasmine is whatever, but it is a very controlled performance while also being very emotional.
Yeah. I think she brings such very, like, vivid emotional shadings to certain scenes in a way that elevates their meaning, or even works against maybe what Alan had intended, where you get, I think of the scene where it's a flashback, and it's important to note if you haven't seen Blue Jasmine, although you're probably not listening to this podcast if you haven't seen Blue Jasmine.
Big spoilers coming, so if you haven't seen, stop, it's on Netflix, go watch it, come back.
The scene where, it's one of the flashback scenes where she's sort of interrogating Alec Baldwin about, I think, this one of his many mistresses.
Yes.
But she's asking if this woman is his mistress or if he's having an affair with her. And the way that her questioning, she's so intense about it, obviously. And all she's doing is really, like, taking off her earrings on the bed. Mm-hmm.
But her face is intense and her whole body's tense.
Yeah. And so, like, her laser-like intensity in that scene just sort of, once he denies it, just sort of slides into this, like, very, almost like, I don't know, like a,
as if a weight
like
has been
lifted. No, like, she's, like, so hot for him in that moment. Like, it's like this possessive lust. And it's like,
of course not. What on earth makes you think that?
Well, someone made a remark.
What remark?
They saw you having lunch with her. Taking her hand.
Oh, what crap. Who told you that? I know who. It was that vacuous troublemaker, Lydia. Am I right?
Were you?
It had to be Lydia because I was having a business lunch with Amy at the Four Seasons.
Did
and Lydia
you
was there.
Take her hand?
Are you nuts? You think if I was having an affair, I'd be crazy enough to have it in public at the Four Seasons?
Well, I don't know. Sometimes you drink at lunch. No, maybe you're high. I mean, it's obvious she's got a crush on you.
Honey, you're building a case.
Because if you were having an affair, I would be pretty upset.
Well, I'm not, so don't get your temper up. I don't like that side of you.
I'm just jealous because I love you. You should be flattered.
I mean, this last viewing of Blue Jasmine, the flashbacks really stood out to me as, like, this very credible portrait of a marriage. Mm-hmm. And I think that's, you know, obviously Blanchett's contribution, but I think Alec Baldwin knows well enough to just, that he doesn't need to do much in those scenes because Blanchett is really telegraphing all that needs to be communicated, so he can just sort of underplay in a way that's, I think, productive for those scenes.
Complimentary.
But, yeah, he's a perfect compliment for her. Mm-hmm. All he has to do is just sort of kind of sidestep her and, you know. But, yeah, the way that that scene just sort of slides from an interrogation into a seduction is, you know, it's very, I mean, it's breathtaking to behold, because I think you just see how quicksilver her emotions are, and it gives that relationship more credibility than I think maybe exists on the page.
Yeah. And this is also, you know, it's sort of back to, and if you want to talk also about building a relationship with Sally Hawkins as her sister, like some of the press that came out around that time is that they both talked about how Woody doesn't rehearse, he doesn't give feedback. Kate talked about how he told her after her first few days on set that she was awful and that she needs to do it again.
Really? I don't think I heard that story.
It is. There is a video in an interview she did during her Oscar campaign to the New York Times, and where she said that he told her, "You're awful," but he didn't give her any feedback what was awful or what to do. And then the reporter would ask her, and then, "So what happened?" And she was like, "Well, I guess it got less awful because he didn't say that again."
I had never heard that story. I think of, there's a story of him bringing Diane Wiestin during Bullets Over Broadway to watch the dailies. Because she admitted too that she just wasn't getting the voice down for that character. And he just brought her in to watch, and he was like, "Do you hear what I hear?" or something like that. And she was like, "Yeah, I'll fix it." And I mean, obviously we get one of the greatest comedic performances of all time as a result. But yeah, it's interesting. Yeah, because I feel like, especially latter day Alan, every actor who's worked with him seems to just say, like, "Yeah, I mean, he's pretty flexible. He's pretty easygoing. Yeah. He'll just... you know, if you want another take, he's fine with it. But, like, you know, he doesn't really give a shit if it needs to be done or not."
Yeah. And one of the things that Sally Hawkins also talked about in interviews is that Kate was on stage in New York doing Uncle Vanya before they shot. And she came to New York and they would do fittings with the costume designer, Susie Bendiger, who does an amazing job in this movie.
She does.
And that's where they rehearsed. That's where they talked to each other. That's when they built the history of the sister. She's like, there was nothing in the screenplay about it except the few things that we see is like they were adopted. Obviously, Jasmine was favored by the mother. And she's like, so they built the history together, just talking to each other about what happened, why did Ginger leave, what was the relationship with the parents. And so this is also sort of feeds into the theory that we have about this, the actors, the auteur. They filled in the gaps in that relationship, with it, which is the central relationship in this movie, even though it is kind of a bit lopsided because the movie is really about just Jasmine.
Yeah. Can I make a confession?
Sure.
I don't love Sally Hawkins in this movie. And I think I usually love Sally Hawkins. I think she's brilliant. I think she's generally underrated. But I don't, something about this performance just doesn't work for me. I don't, it's, and it's not just the very almost like alien New York accent that just doesn't, it's just that, you know, it sounds like it's, like, the cadences just are weird. And,
yeah.
But I think it's almost, it could be that Kate is working on such a heightened level that Sally Hawkins isn't. I think Sally Hawkins, like Baldwin, maybe just wanted to, is, you know, underplaying.
And stay out of the way.
Yeah.
And stay out of the way of the hurricane.
Yeah, exactly. And I think, like, her best moments are her just sort of looking at Jasmine and confusion or horror. But I find,
what is going on, Jasmine? Yes, she has a few of those. Yeah.
But I find the solo scenes of her, you know, pursuing when she's in relationship with Bobby Cannavale and then later with Louis C.K. Something is just not clicking for me. And I think also one of my main quibbles with the movie overall, which I guess is a flawed movie with an extraordinary performance that, you know, gives it a reason for being. But one of my quibbles is that I just never buy the backstory as written. Because I think the backstory, the scant details that we get imply that they were both adopted, Jasmine and Ginger.
Yes.
And I think they're from upstate New York or something like that.
I don't think it's clear.
Yeah. I don't, and so something, and that, you know, obviously Jasmine was favored and then Ginger ran away? One of them ran away?
Yeah, she ran away, Ginger did.
So something about the backstory, I never believe it when I'm watching Sally Hawkins. And I don't necessarily believe it when I'm watching Kate either, but it's almost besides the point when I'm watching Kate. Yeah. Because there's just so much else going on.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like Sally Hawkins is generally playing it as straight as she can.
Mm-hmm.
But there's nothing I almost wish she would experiment more
yeah.
with that character and you know, or attempt to take it to the register that Kate's performing in. Just because I think the backstory just doesn't benefit them. And, you know, I don't believe her as, like, Andrew Dice Clay's wife. It's just, it's a very hard sell on that one.
I thought that she, like, we talked about how the screenplay is uneven. Mm-hmm. And I think she suffers from the fact that her scenes are, for some reason, just not written as well. Like, the whole relationship with Louis C.K. is kind of comes out of nowhere and goes out of nowhere and sort of becomes a big thing and then is resolved immediately. And even the whole thing with Bobby Cannavale is not really, I hope they had showed me more. I wish they had showed me more fire, because that's like, Bobby Cannavale is playing Stanley. He's giving him the fire, the sex appeal, the like big emotions, the crying, the everything. But it's just like, all of that for Ginger? Like, I didn't get it.
We love Sally Hawkins, but in that context, for sure. Yeah, but also, and I think it's just that Woody isn't really, I wouldn't say he's, even throughout the screenplay, really building these characters so much as just putting them in new scenarios that they react to emotionally. Like, I don't think, these characters aren't really, like, transforming moment to moment. And I think that's especially true of Ginger. And so I think Sally Hawkins suffers for that like lack of interest in like, you know, her character's psychology or interiority. But whereas like, you know, Woody is more than fine, you know, instead of building character for Jasmine, like why not just have her pop a few pills and that'll be enough detail to hold the film through.
Yeah.
Like, but Kate Blanchett is making it these like little details that are, you know, Woody just like these shortcuts that he's in of his screenplay. I think are really actually
what are you,
the fuel for Kate's performance. Mm-hmm. They're giving her a
give like, me an example of these shortcuts.
I feel like there could be so much more to Jasmine beyond just the pill popping and the alcohol guzzling. I think it's, you know, in a way we've seen that in Woody's films, right? I mean, anyone who's watched, you know, Husbands and Wives or even, you know, Geraldine Page in Interiors, like are familiar with these, like, you know, mad women, these everyday mad women who are going under. And it doesn't feel like he's elevating his interest in these women.
Mm-hmm.
But I think they're reliant upon the talents of an actress like Kate Blanchett or an actress like Judy Davis or Geraldine Page who can bring more, you know, animation to it so that we believe it even in spite of the script shortcomings.
Yeah. And he just gets out of the way.
Yes. Which is important.
And he does get out of Kate's way in this movie a lot. Some of the shot compositions, like the whole scenes that are set in the Hamptons, I was watching these yesterday. I'm like, why is the camera there? And like, it's a whole long scene that just plays in one setting when there are like multiple characters, but there are some characters whose faces you never see because he's just shooting from behind. I'm like, oh, he's just putting the camera on Kate for this whole long scene. And I guess he didn't do coverage or he just decided not to use it because the force of Kate's performance is just like, he's entrapped as the audience is just wanting to watch her even when she is not active in the scene.
And I think that force... I think that force can almost become a liability in the movie in relation to Alan's direction specifically, because I'm thinking now of the scene in which Jasmine comes back to Ginger's apartment for the last time.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, you know, it's the second to last scene of the movie. Mm-hmm. She's just been dumped by Peter Sarsgaard and
she's mid breakdown.
Her stepson has discovered the betrayal that she's you know wielded on his now dead father, and she comes home, and it's her rock bottom. Her hair is matted to her face.
She's mascara so sweaty.
Is running.
Yeah.
She's stammering, stumbling, and you know because it's Cate Blanchett, and she's just this Amazonian figure. Like, all of these characteristics just are so much more heightened because, I mean, her height alone is, you know, so striking and so overwhelming. But, you know, so she's this unignorable figure in the shot compositions or even, like, as she's just entering a frame. And so she enters the scene looking like this with, like, her mascara running and her hair matted. And Bobby Cannavale and Sally Hawkins are just on the couch acting like nothing has changed.
They haven't. They don't see what we see.
And it's just, in a way, there's just like no connection to
reality.
Reality. It's almost like Alan isn't ready, isn't as observant as maybe he should have been to the intensity that Kate is bringing, just by even just an appearance alone. Mm-hmm. You know.
Yeah. She's definitely intense in every single scene. I do want to go back to Sally Hawkins for just a second and say that one of my most favorite bits in this whole movie is when she meets Alec Baldwin for the first time in the flashback to New York, and she curtsies, which is such a cute little moment. And it's sort of that moment. I wish, to your point earlier, that she was going full throttle. I think this is a moment where she's not going full throttle, but she is giving a sort of unique characteristic of Ginger, is that she's so just overwhelmed by this big, powerful man that she thinks of him as some sort of king.
That is a good one. Yeah, that's a great detail. One scene that I really like, and I think everyone is performing well in, but I mean, obviously, especially Kate, it's when Ginger first introduces Jasmine to Chili.
Mm, and he brings his friend,
played by Max Casella. And it's just, it's a long scene. It goes on very long. And it's, I mean, I don't think we're being really filled into many new details about Jasmine's past, but just the sheer discomfort that Kate is telegraphing through that makes it excruciating, but in a way that's, I mean, I think it's, you know, whereas it would have just been this kind of, you know, broadly comedic
scene
or meeting of opposites, it becomes really just a kind of an endurance test in which we're seeing if this woman, this character, can withstand a lunch with her sister's boyfriend and this guy that has been foolishly
all these people she doesn't like.
Yes.
And it also shows us, like, she is so in her head in that scene. She's an island. Like, she is with these other three people in the scene, but Jasmine is an island in that scene. Because while she would sometimes say something in response to whatever they're saying to her, the performance shows us that Jasmine is just in her head in that scene. Even, it's in the screenplay, obviously, because there are things that we need where she just stares into the distance and they're sort of like asking her about that and calling her out on that. But for the most part, they don't notice what an island she is and how she's not with them, really.
Yeah. One thing I love about the performance is almost how class conscious her gaze is. Mm. I noticed this time around that she never seems to hold eye contact with either with Sally Hawkins or Bobby Cannavale. Like, she does that thing where she can be looking directly at them, but there's no life.
Oh,
underneath the eyes, you know, it's just, she's just enduring this conversation, or her mind is just completely elsewhere in a, you know, a past that won't stop bothering her. But in her scenes with Alec Baldwin and Peter Sarsgaard, I think that's the only time we really see Blanchett sustaining eye contact with the scene partner. But I think that even deepens the characterization so that we understand Jasmine as a character who really only blooms under the gaze of these wealthy, powerful men who she feels some sense of protection from.
Or just like they're worth her time.
Yeah, 100%. Of course.
What I love also about this performance is all the bits when Kate as Jasmine will just stop and either stare into the distance or...
I saw you, Erica.
Yes. Or just when she's with Peter Sarsgaard and, like, she's telling all these lies, but she stops, like, before the lie comes out of her, as if she's thinking what the lie should be. Mm-hmm. Like, after she says New York Park Avenue, she stops a little bit. That's not a lie. But then she has to lie about her husband, and she says he's a surgeon. Mm-hmm. When, you know, he's not. So it shows us, like, oh, Jasmine is thinking about these lies, and she's not a very good liar, even though, you know, Dwight is just so clueless that he takes in everything.
He seems like a completely naive idiot in a way. Yeah. I mean, a handsome idiot because he's Peter Sarsgaard, but...
He's Mitch. Mitch is like that.
Yeah. But almost like wanting... I mean, who wouldn't want to be seduced by Kate Blanchett, right, at that point? But one of the things I love... is almost like how perfectly timed her her gaze will be to the flashback. Like, mm-hmm. you'll see, like, her eyes going foggy, and then it's right to... I mean, it's really a tribute to the editing, but I think she... I mean, she's obviously familiar with the script, so she knows, like, when these flashbacks will occur.
Mm-hmm.
She knows when Jasmine's mind is going elsewhere. And she gives it... But she gives those flashbacks a kind of sense. I mean, you know, we see the character in the midst of remembering, as opposed to these flashbacks just happening, yeah. you know, willy-nilly. They're given a sort of tangible, you know, they reasoning become, in the movie. They become the performance, rather.
Yeah, and they become, like, when you go, you just feel it. It becomes very sort of emotionally monumentous
yes.
when they cut to the flashback. You yes. know something's about to happen. And, you know, you're mentioning the editing. It made me think a little bit about, like, did she give the editor lots of choices? Because, you know, Woody is known for not taking many takes, but yeah. it's like that precision in, like, definitely this performance is like a go all out broke. She's sweaty. She's big. And, yeah. you know, it needs a little bit of control from the editor. So.
But I think she's giving, at least from what we can see in the finished product, like there mm-hmm. seem to be these cues to an editor or, you know, that are aligned with the screenplay's
yeah.
structure where we see her amidst, you know, a moment of remembrance so that it, and as, I mean, there are some flashbacks where it's just like, well, is she really thinking about that right now? Like, it's just like Woody wanting to get these expository dialogue scenes out of the way so that we understand the characters later mm-hmm. on. But I think she gives it a kind of reasoning just through the transparency of what she's doing.
Yeah. Talking about the screenplay, this movie is full of amazing one-liners. And
yes.
I don't know who gets the credit here, because obviously they pop off, and Woody's known for writing good mm-hmm. dialogue.
Yes.
But it's just Blanchett's delivery. It's like, I can hear these things. I saw you, Erica, which you just mentioned. That whole thing is just like, that whole story she tells is just so memorable. And the punchline of I saw you, Erica, is just like something I hear all the time. Just
yeah.
the delivery of it.
I think that's the one, if I really want to be, if I'm really trying to procrastinate, I think that's like the one scene from Blue Jasmine I'll go back and just watch. I think because it's on YouTube or something.
Yeah, it is. Yeah.
But there, yeah, there's just something so entrancing
mm-hmm.
and kind of nerve-wracking about
yeah.
watching her just recount this story that brings up all of this sudden vitriolic,
yeah.
you know, a statement.
And she goes, like, it started as a nice moment. She's just reconnecting with her sister. And then by the end of it, she, like, hates the whole world. And she looks strung
yeah.
out. And
yeah.
it's like, and to the, you know, Ginger then is just like, are you okay? And I was feeling that, too. It's like, are you okay?
Yeah. And I think even there, you see, like, it doesn't feel like spiritually, like, Blanchett is in the room. Or that Jasmine is in the room, rather. Like, whatever Blanchett is doing, she just seems to be, like, receding so that her entire interiority is just consumed with the past. She's
mm-hmm.
not even looking at Sally Hawkins in that scene. And, you know, it's Sally Hawkins is the one who sort of has to zap her out of this
yeah.
trance that she's put herself
yeah.
in. But I think it's the film is more interesting in a way for instances like that where Kate is choosing not to interact with Sally Hawkins, or she's,
yeah.
you know, keeping herself at this purposeful remove that
mm-hmm.
you know is powerful to watch, but also I think speaks volumes about the relationship between Jasmine and Ginger, who
mm-hmm.
aren't people that really connect
yeah.
at the end of the day.
I want to go back to school. I want to get my degree and become, you know, something substantial. I can't just do some mindless job. Oh, I was forced to take a job selling shoes on Madison Avenue. Oh, so humiliating. Friends I'd had at dinner parties, our apartment came in and I waited on them. I mean, do you have any idea what that's like? No, one minute you're hosting women and the next you're measuring their shoe size and fitting them. Erica Bishop came into the store. She saw me. It was so embarrassed for me. She slipped out thinking I didn't see her. I saw you, Erica!
You okay?
Another scene also that's full of these zingers and these one-liners is where she's babysitting the two children at Chuck E. Cheese. And that scene should not work. It should not work. Like, it's so extraneous. It's just about her telling us, basically, I think Woody couldn't find a way to get us to the next bit of the story. So he's like, oh, let's just have a scene where she tells us what happened.
Yeah.
And it should not work. But it works because she's like, she has the big line about, you know, anxiety and nightmares and a nervous breakdown.
Mm-hmm.
And then the one about tip big boys. It's like there's so many one-liners and you're just watching her. And also she starts the scene, she's just happy-go-lucky. She's happy Dwight is in her life. She's enjoying her night out with these kids that she obviously doesn't like because she doesn't like anybody. And then by the end of it, she's also in another trance and she's just like talking about anxiety and nightmares. And you're like, oh my God, she is in a nightmare right now.
Yeah. I would say that's one of the scenes in Blue Jasmine that truly beggars belief. It almost seems like those kids are just not on the same set.
No. Yeah. Probably weren't.
And you don't, it's like supposed to be a Chuck E. Cheese, but there's nothing telling about it being a Chuck E. Cheese.
It's just a diner.
It's just some diner that would let Woody Allen shoot his, you know, a scene there. But yeah, even the transition in that scene is crazy, as you said. I mean, it begins as her, you know, clearly tipsy and very, you know, blight and, you know, in jovial spirits. And then almost the way, like, her body is contorting so that she's just sort of, like, hunchbacked.
Mm, by the end
and,
of
like,
it, yeah.
And, like, very, you know, grim-faced is... I mean, it makes you want to call child services is what it makes you want to do. But it's... Yeah, it's fascinating to behold, even though it makes no sense within the context of the story why this character would be telling...
These young boys this story, yeah.
And so... Because her performance is so overwhelming and just so, you know, rendered in boldface from top to bottom, it's these almost like psychological inconsistencies you're not concerned with them.
Yeah, because you're just so entrapped by the performance.
Yes.
And you're just deep in watching this amazing actor just turn this scene that, you know, I already said this, but it bears repeating.
Yeah.
Should not work.
Yeah.
And somebody, you know, when you were editing this movie, you come upon this scene and you're like, oh, we don't need that. But just the performance is so amazing that then it becomes, when I first saw this movie, that was the scene for me.
Yeah.
That was like, oh, this is her Oscar clip. This is the scene where she sealed that Oscar win. You know, looking back now, it's the whole performance. There are so many other scenes where she's better. But it is a scene maybe because the writing isn't as sharp, but the performance is sharper because she needed to make the writing better.
And so I think it's really maybe just a great summation of the performance as a whole, which is, you know, making these irresolvable contradictions in Woody Allen's writing,
mm-hmm.
in his conception of these characters, are just part of this specific human being.
Mm-hmm.
I think that Kate Blanchett makes us believe they belong to Jasmine, whereas an actress who... you know, a lesser actress,
yes.
as most actresses are compared to Kate Blanchett, but, you know, might not be able to manage.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And this is the big thing about this movie. Like, I can't imagine somebody else doing it. And I think if somebody else had played this, I don't think we would be talking about it 7 years later.
I mean, I can maybe only imagine, like, Judy Davis,
yes.
circa Husbands and Wives. I mean, that's really the performance that this character is indebted
mm-hmm.
to. And one of the great, great performances in Woody Allen's is filmography.
And Kate, you know, as a fellow Australian, has always been in sort of the Judy Davis
mm-hmm.
school of acting.
Yes.
Yes. So they have a similar sort of just like going for broke and while being so entertaining and heartbreaking and big and everything.
Yeah. Well, I think they're both actors who aren't afraid to be caught acting, you know?
Mm, yeah. Oh, that's a great way of putting it.
You know, so that... I mean, and what's great about Jasmine as played by Kate is that I think of a scene where she's in Ginger's apartment and she's awaiting Peter Sarsgaard's phone call.
Mm.
All this chaos. I think it's when Bobby Cannavale
storms
comes in
and he's like, asking Ginger about going out to a date with Louis C.K.
Yeah,
a whole bunch of things happening.
He's flinging her like across the room. He's like breaking a lamp and all... Kate Blanchett can focus on is getting this phone call, once the phone does ring,
mm-hmm.
I just love the way that she she has to sit down, mm-hmm. and she has to sort of just compose herself. And then even when she picks up the phone, is on the phone call, like, she's timing it, you know, she puts the phone down for a second and, you know, just waits like a certain amount of time that she thinks is like an appropriate amount of time before for someone, yeah. like to give the impression that she's busy.
Yeah.
But in scenes like that, you really understand that, oh, being Jasmine is a performance, mm. you know?
Yeah.
And going back to the backstory of it, like, I think it's interesting. I mean, I can't imagine Cate Blanchett ever having lived the life as described by Alan or being like an anthropology student at Boston University. I mean, that stretches belief even by Woody Allen standards. Yeah. But in a moment like that, I think, because we're still watching Blanchett fabricate a performance, and because we're watching a character whose life is a performance, mm-hmm. I mean, there's so much that we can't even imagine about Jasmine that's not even explained about the character. Like, mm-hmm. how did she get into this world where she might meet a man like Alec Baldwin yeah. and become his wife? Like,
the only clue is that she changed her name from Jeanette to right. Jasmine. That's it.
Yeah. Like, how did she get to the party where she heard Blue Moon and you know, they fell in love? I think you do understand that the character could do this because we see Blanchett sort of just
doing it.
She's
doing it. She forces you to be convinced.
She foregrounds the process of mm-hmm. putting together a character so that we understand Jasmine as someone who is, you know, essentially put herself together.
Yeah.
Like an actress playing a character.
Yeah. Yeah. And this performance is a performance of building blocks.
Yeah.
For instance, when she played Katharine Hepburn, that was also a performance where she built blocks. You know, uh-huh. it's like the hair and then the voice, then the body. This is also a performance of that. But I think it's deeper than that. So she is emotionally building blocks. So mm-hmm. it's a crescendo, right? So at the beginning, when we start with her in San Francisco, she's trying this new life. There is mm-hmm. maybe a little bit of hope. And then, you know, it keeps building, and at the beginning it's going towards like, oh, this is going to resolve nicely with Dwight, but then it takes a swerve, and it's as if all that she built is then it's you just reach the top of the volcano, and then the revelations happen, and mm-hmm. you see the revelations happening twice in San Francisco and in New York, mm-hmm. and that's where everything just blows up. It completely blows up. I love, you know, how in the performance become, it's always a physical performance, but it becomes very physical in very two distinct scenes. One where after Dwight finds out all her lies and she's getting out of the car and everything falls out of her bag and she has to pick it up. Mm-hmm. And that is, you know, you get it again with Alec Baldwin after he tells her he's fallen in love with Lizette mm-hmm. Boudreau. What a name. and then everything also, why is she carrying all these things in her handbag? But anyway, everything in her handbag also falls out on the couch and she has to try. She's looking for the Xanax or whatever she's looking. And those two scenes, you know, are the zenith of like, this is Jasmine's bottom. Mm-hmm. And it's the sort of intelligence of the performance that she shows us those two things are as two bookends mm-hmm. and similar emotionally, even though she is a different place in her life.
Yeah. And I think it's interesting that, you know, even though her style is so exaggerated at that point, mm-hmm. as is the performance mostly on the whole, it's still devastating to witness. It's still incredibly alarming. And mm-hmm. I think just throughout the movie, there's Blanchett builds this sort of terror in the audience, you mm-hmm. know, where we're wondering, like, is this going to be the scene in which she just flatlines completely and mm-hmm. just, you know, self-annihilates?
I thought she was going to commit suicide.
Everything that follows the phone call to the FBI and the purse scene where she jumps out mm-hmm. of Peter Sarsgaard's car, you know, those are the climaxes, and everything after that is just sort of like the shell-shocked effect of it. I feel like the ending specifically, I'm completely unable to imagine Jasmine lifting herself off that bench at the end.
That's it. She's going to be on that bench till she croaks and dies. Yeah.
But, yeah. And it just feels like the film could only end there in a way, just because mm. any future seems unimaginable. I mean, it almost seems like she's renounced any possible future for herself. So, and it's like, you know, there's this sort of unconscious embrace of her own insanity. And in that way, it's a kind of death. Yeah, you know?
It is.
I mean, we don't even need to see the character commit suicide because really any future is just, she's foreclosed any glimpse of a future.
Yeah, that bench is her coffin.
Yeah, 100%.
You know, if we're talking about, you know, Kate is the auteur of this movie, Woody Allen definitely let her down with that whole computer subplot thing. Because what world do we live in 2012-13 when this movie was shot and released that somebody needs to go to class to learn how to use a computer?
Well, that's one of the reasons why I believe the screenplay was written in 1984 or something. You know,
probably, like, yes.
I mean, in a way you can imagine a character as just hopeless as Jasmine needing mm-hmm. to go to one of those classes.
Yeah.
Again, just because Cate Blanchett looks like Cate Blanchett, I can't possibly imagine her ever
touching a computer screen.
in a class with that many normal looking people.
Yeah.
But, you know, there's that scene where she's talking to the friend that she makes in that class who invites her to the party where she eventually meets Peter Sarsgaard's character. I can't suspend my disbelief in that scene, and yet it's almost just like this odd survey of like, what if we put Cate Blanchett in a computer class and
will
just
it work?
To go wild, her to evoke Jenna Rollins and you know, at her most untethered.
Yeah, I mean, it works if you think that, you know, Jasmine is always self-sabotaging. Mm-hmm. So I think of it as like, oh, for me to be able to have any job or career, I need to study this thing, but let me make this thing very hard for me so I can't actually get to have a career. So it's another way of her self-sabotaging, similar to calling the FBI on Hal, similar to the lies she tells Dwight, similar to all the things that she does in the movie to self-sabotage. It's giving herself another roadblock that maybe she can't recover from.
Yeah.
That's the only way that it's believable.
Or even, I think it kind of speaks to maybe dubious inclination that Woody Allen has, where he wants us to sort of laugh at these well-to-do women who's clearly suffering from some serious mental issues and just put her in these debased circumstances. Like, the whole dentist subplot, too, I mean, it works a bit more than the computer class, but is she wearing scrubs at one point or something?
Yeah, she is, yeah.
Or it's just... You can't wrap your head around it.
Yeah. I mean, it is. It shows us, you know, she works for a sexual predator. And it sort of shows us, like, you know, somebody who looks like that, you know, maybe would attract that sort of man. But I don't know. Like, it's a contained subplot that doesn't sort of feed into the rest of the story. So it is a little odd.
Yeah, it just feels like Woody kind of grasping at straws. But she also makes it work because, I mean, just her complete ineptitude in these jobs is hilarious to watch.
It's very funny. I think that's where she is the funniest.
Yeah.
Because sometimes she is funny with all those one-liners, but you're just afraid to laugh because she might completely melt down in the next scene.
Yeah. Like, like any inclination to laugh, you worry could, you know, precede a potential suicide attempt or something like that. It's alarming.
She's so dominant in this movie. Who do you think she had the best scenes with? You talked earlier about Alec Baldwin. Is that who you think she had the best scenes with?
I think those are the most believable scenes, I would say. I like that he's underplaying again.
Mm-hmm.
I like that he's just ceding the stage to her. And I just believe him as that character 100%.
Mm.
So that, you know, I can focus on... You know, I mean, I'm always focusing on Cate Blanchett, but in those scenes
you can't not in this movie.
I think because he's so restrained, it gives her a lot of flexibility to just sort of manipulate the course of those scenes as she pleases, to vivify them with unexpected emotions. So yeah, those are definitely my favorite scenes. But what would you say? Who do you think she has the best scenes with?
I enjoyed Bobby Cannavale. The movie's not interested in any relationship between them, because that's the one thing that's different from Streetcar, right? It's like there's no sexual chemistry between them whatsoever.
Mm-hmm.
But I do like the scene where he's trying clumsily to find out how long she's gonna stay at Ginger's, and at the same time he's trying to tell her that his friend wants her phone number, which is completely unbelievable because...
That is, yes, another... Has he not looked at her once during this entire lunch? It makes no sense why he would ask for her phone number.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I think the tension between the characters to me was palpable. And that's, I think maybe he's definitely, nobody's playing at Kate's level in this movie, but I think in that scene, just because there's so much tension, unsaid tension between them, I thought he came closest.
Yeah, I think a stronger version of this movie might have explored that dynamic further. Because, yeah, it is, I mean, that is obvious. It's one of the fundamental, it is the fundamental dynamic in Streetcar Named Desire. So it's odd that it just kind of gets, you know, short shrifted here. Mm-hmm.
This was playing on the vineyard. Blue moon. I used to know the words. I know the words. Now they're all a jumble.
Starts with her telling the story of Blue Moon and ends with it saying the story of Blue Moon. I don't know that there is anything more to mention, but I just thought that that was very poignant in that when she talks about Blue Moon at the beginning, she's telling a happy story. Mm-hmm. And when at the end, she's telling the same story, basically. Just the performance is different and the way she tells it is very sad and heartbreaking. And I think that's sort of, that's the journey that we've been in. Mm-hmm. And this movie's a bummer of an ending and just that it ends with that story. I give credit to the writing, but I also give credit to just the performance of that. Makes you end the movie, even though nobody likes Jasmine, right? Like, she's not somebody you like or want to be around at all. Mm-hmm. But the way that she tells those two stories, the same story differently, it just breaks my heart.
Yeah, and I mean, it's easy to take for granted just how believable she is. I mean, we hear it on the soundtrack, Blue Moon, mm-hmm. but I'm sure when she was filming it, it wasn't playing.
Yeah.
And yet, you never for one second doubt that this character is hearing it, mm-hmm. you know, unfold as she's relaying the story, yeah. Which is just a credit to, you know, this exceptionally physicalized performance where, you know, she strikes this fascinating balance between, you know, being in a scene, because so much of the character's action is storytelling, or, you know, weaving this fiction or mm-hmm. weaving this fantasy of a life she once led, but, you know, while also having one foot in that same past, so that she, you know, she's always there, but she still has to maintain a presence in her present. Mm-hmm. So yeah, that's, I just find that balance really fascinating, and it's something that Kate, you know, makes possible for the character, and it's something that even you couldn't necessarily say exists at the level of the script, because it's almost like its own special effect in a way.
Oh yeah, for sure. That's a great way of putting it. Okay, now let's end on a fun, positive note, because the ending is such a bummer. Have you, in real life, ever said any of the many zingers and one-liners that Kate says in Blue Jasmine?
Do you mean, like, quoting it? Or
like I have said, I saw you, Erica.
Me too.
I've said that many times when, you know, when I'm questioning people who are, like, you know, telling a little bit of a line. I'm like, I saw you, Erica.
Yeah, I would say that's the one line I remember most vividly from this movie. And it's all in the delivery.
Yeah.
You know.
Because it's not, like, I saw you, Erica, is not that interesting or memorable, but it's the way it's delivered.
And because she's, you know, screaming it at full blast, it's pretty iconic. But what's the other line that she has that's really...
Who do you have to sleep with around here to get a stolen martini with a twist of lemon?
Maybe I'll start incorporating that into my daily conversation. Just so, you know, at work, at home, you know. Yeah.
That's a good one. So we're talking about, you know, in this episode of Sundays We Skate, about Kate Blanchett as an auteur of Blue Jasmine. And you have written about Juliette Binoche mm-hmm. as an auteur. Tell us what movie and what did you find out with Juliette?
Yeah, well, I wrote about Binoche for the symposium that the site Reverse Shot did this past summer, which was essentially looking a career-long look at Binoche's performance with the theory of Binoche as the auteur of her performances and of her films, in a way, in mind. Mm-hmm. So I looked at Cachet.
And that movie's sort of like, it's not like a Juliette Binoche dominant movie because it's a two-hander with Daniel Etoy.
Yeah. But what I noticed on as I was writing this piece was that I think you need actresses of Binoche's stature in a role like that. Or an actress. I think also it's just because Juliette Binoche is a maximalist actress, you know?
What do you mean by that?
Almost in the same way as Cate Blanchett and Blue Jasmine, is that she's more inclined to play something to the hilt than she is to rein it in or to, you know, underplay a line or a scene.
You've also written a series about Meryl Streep, who's another actor who's an auteur, because a Meryl movie is a Meryl movie. You almost never think of the director. At least I don't. I think of Meryl.
I don't think she does either.
So, you know, you've basically saw every single movie Meryl has made and written about all of them, right? So is there, tell us just one example of this theory, or a movie where you felt that what she was doing as the auteur of that film really worked and made the movie better. Which, a movie is always better with Meryl, but what's the best example of that?
I don't know if it's the best example, but the one that sprang quickest to mind is The Post.
And that's a recent one, yeah.
Yeah, but what I really think about when I think about that movie is I think of her on the phone. Just the gradations of her ambivalence and that scene, you know, it's I think she almost makes that decision, like the climax of the movie, within maybe what is a few minutes, you get just like the tiniest flickers of, you know, a woman
making a decision,
that she knows will, you know, determine the entire course of her life. And I think Meryl communicates that to the max. And it's not even that she's overplaying it, but she finds a way to make it
seismic.
Transparent. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and to make it seismic. Exactly.
Yeah. Legends all. Binoche, Streep, Blanchett. But let's go back to Cate. I want to ask you a few questions about Cate, because we always do this on Sundays with Cate.
Please.
Do you remember the first time you saw Cate? What movie was it?
This isn't the first time I saw Cate. I think probably the first time I saw Cate was maybe Lord of the Rings or even honestly Indiana Jones. just because I was young at the time. But the first time I really saw Cate was, so when Notes on a Scandal came out, I was 13.
Oh, wow.
I was obviously as a proto-gay child, you know, wanting to... I was obsessed with the Oscars and, of course, wanted to see it, but I knew, you know, from the trailer alone that this is not something my parents are going to let me see. So I think I had to wait, like, maybe a year or two before I could rent it on iTunes behind their back.
Oh, my God. I love that story.
And then watch it on my phone in bed.
Yeah.
But I remember watching it, and it's not really one of my favorite Blanchett performances.
I love the movie.
I mean, it's just... it's a wild fucking movie.
It's so wild.
But I remember watching... I remember watching it in bed, and I remember the scene where Blanchett storms out of her house, and the mascara is running.
Yes.
And her hair is wild.
Here I am!
And I remember watching that on my iPhone, or my iPod, sorry, Richard Eyre, that I was watching it on my iPod. Scrolling back and then watching it again and then doing that maybe like two or three more times just because I was like, oh, this is crazy. Yeah. And this, I mean, in my mind, that the louder the performance, the better at that point. I don't think I watched it since then, actually, but so I'm not sure how well it would hold up. But
it holds up. I've watched, you know, but, you know, I'm very not the best witness as quick when it comes to Cate, but I love it.
Yeah. I'm sure it's still, like, a delectable, bonkers
And Judy's
movie.
Amazing. Judy Dench is so great.
That was the first time I really became aware of her as just a force.
Yeah. And is there a time when you thought she was underrated?
I asked John is my partner, about this yesterday, and he said, Carol. I mean, she didn't win any major award for it. And we have Xavier Dolan to thank for that.
Fuck Xavier Dolan.
We know what you did.
At Cannes. Fuck you, Dolan.
I mean, you said it, I know that. But, so obviously, she's not underrated in Carol.
Everybody loves that.
She deserves some more awards for it. Yeah. But I would say, I think in Truth, that same year, she's pretty great.
Yeah,
I think she's
a great performance.
Again, we're watching an actress just imbue this part with so much emotional life, mm-hmm. and, you know, making the movie better by, you know, because of it.
Mm-hmm.
But I also thought she was pretty good in Where'd You Go, Bernadette?
Oh my God, I love you for that, because nobody likes that movie. I think there's, it's probably you, me, and seven other people who saw it, but I like her in it too.
I have this theory, and I floated it by John a few times, so he's well aware of it, but I only think that Kate really flourishes when she's playing extraordinary women, and whether I feel like, you know, whether it's extraordinarily royal or extraordinarily demented, as in Blue Jasmine, or extraordinarily Carol, you know, like, or extraordinarily Bob Dylan,
or a genius like in Bernadette.
Yeah, and so she's, you know, I think maybe a director who's a little less lax than Richard Linklater might have really realized the potential of that match between actress and character, but I think for what it is, I think she gives it, I just found it very moving.
Yeah,
I feel like she really responded to that character and the unfulfilled potential of it, of that character specifically.
Yeah, the Golden Globes agrees.
Well, but again, I think you look at, people, you know, look at that nomination and you think, oh, of course they nominated her. It's Cate Blanchett. They just nominate her by default. But I think she earned it.
Yeah, I thought it was a deserved nomination. Yeah.
I mean, I don't think it's going to be in the, you know, it won't be like the film people hold up when.
No, because the film itself is not entirely successful.
Yeah, but I think she makes you realize or even think about the tougher, you know, more coherent film that might have been.
Yeah. So Kate, as we speak, is on set with
Guillermo
del Toro. With Rooney, but also with Guillermo del Toro.
Yeah.
So that begs two questions. Who is your favorite Kate scene partner? The most common answer for that is Rooney. And who would you like to see her work with? Well, you can say Rooney.
Okay, obviously my answer is Rooney Mara.
Yeah.
Because it's, I mean, perfection. I wouldn't say maybe it's, I mean, after Rooney. Mm-hmm. But I love what she establishes with Matt Damon in Ripley.
Oh, interesting. Oh, Ripley's so delicious.
Yeah, I mean, just an exquisite, beautiful, perfectly cast movie. And in a role that we don't really see her try any. I mean, or that she's never really been cast in before since then. You know, this earnest, kind of awkward society woman. I mean, usually when she's playing society women, she's confident and very Carol-esque.
Yeah.
But there's something so moving about the way she pines for Matt Damon in that movie. And the way that he seems ready to reciprocate it. Or maybe not even reciprocate it, but the way he seems equally touched by her affections and definitely fond of her.
Yeah.
The bond between them in that seems very pure and innocent.
Yeah.
And she brings out something new in him, and I think he also responds pretty beautifully to her affections in that movie.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now that you brought The Talented Mr. Ripley, I just thought of an answer for my own question, is like, who would I like to see her work with?
Mm-hmm.
And it's a sad answer because it will never happen. She and Philip Seymour Hoffman have never been in a movie together, and they were such good friends in real life. So that's sad that we'll never see that, because they are as intense. Both of them are very intense actors, and I would have just loved to see that combustion. What would have happened?
I would probably pay any exorbitant fee to see them in like a Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf revival.
Yeah, oh my God, yes.
Yeah, that's a great answer. Oh, you've just devastated me. And you wanted to end on an uplifting note, Murtada.
I'm sorry. Yeah, that's such a sad answer.
I'd like to see her work with Viola Davis, and Viola Davis has gone on record as saying that's who she would like to work with. I mean, I don't know what movie that would be.
Let them remake Lila and Eve. Anything, by this point it doesn't matter, right? Like,
I don't know. It'd be amazing to see them on stage together. I don't think I would survive that production, it would be. Yeah.
Because they're both people who love to work on stage.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like my answer to that question could just be Kate and any actress, you know?
Yeah. Meryl.
Meryl, or even like...
Marion Cotillard.
I mean, we know that... Oh my God, don't even get me started. That would blow my mind. I think Kate would probably really... We know how hard she rides for Amy Adams.
Oh yes, she loves Amy, yeah.
I think that would be
that's her favorite
very
actress.
Exciting.
Yeah.
Yeah, so Kate and any actress.
And Kate and Amy don't do the same thing. They are not the same type of actor. So that would be really something to behold.
Yeah. Someone's got to do it.
Yeah.
We need more Cate Blanchett with actress collaborations.
Thank you so much, Matthew. This was such a joy to have you on to talk about Blue Jasmine and everything. You were a fantastic guest. And before we go, why don't you tell our listeners where they can find you and your work?
You can find me on Twitter, begrudgingly tweeting, at @Ang_Matthew. You can find my work at TribecaFilm.com or by my own website, MatthewAng.net. Read me if you want, or don't.
And you can find me on Twitter at @ME_says and follow the podcast on Twitter and Instagram @SundaysWithKate. And until next time, thank you for listening.